In the early hours of Wednesday, February 11th, Victoria weighed anchor and put the island of Timor astern, sailing along a southwesterly course. With Java, and later on Sumatra, barely visible to starboard, she headed for her meeting with destiny at the Cape of Good Hope. The struggle with the elements was joined within days of leaving Timor, as Victoria became the plaything of the unstable weather systems of the southern latitudes. Pigafetta explained, "In order that we might double the Cape of Good Hope, we descended to 42 degrees on the side of the Antarctic Pole. We were 9 weeks near that cape with our sails hauled down because we had the west and northwest winds on our bow quarter and because of a most furious storm." Although the Cape of Good Hope was first rounded in 1488 by Bartolomeu Dias and 9 years later by Vasco da Gama, both major accomplishments in Portuguese exploration history, it was still considered extremely hazardous and barely navigable, even by the most seaworthy of ships and the most experienced of captains. It occupied a nearly mythical place in the Portuguese consciousness as the most fearsome passage in the entire world. Sebastián Elcano had never experienced anything like the fierce, confused winds and riptides of Cabo Tormentoso. Doubling it would tax his navigational skills, his patience, and his daring to the utmost. Many of the crew wanted to jump ship at the island of Madagascar rather than risk doubling the cape. Doing so meant a life of exile and slavery because Madagascar was a Portuguese stronghold. Over the following days and weeks, the crew, hovering on the verge of starvation and dreading the onset of scurvy, steadily ate their way through their supply of rice and awaited whatever destiny had in store. 1,500 miles to the east, Trinidad prepared to leave the island of Tidor. On April 6th, after more than 3 months of repairs, she finally weighed anchor and unfurled her sails. The ship carried a full load of spices, 1,000 quintals of cloves, 50 tons, more than enough to justify the expense of the entire voyage. Magellan's former flagship was commanded by Gonzalo Gomez de Espinosa, and her pilot was Juan Bautista Ponzarol, known to history as the Genoese pilot, after the name of the short memoir of the voyage he left behind. Sorely missed was Juan Carvalho, the capable pilot who had become a corrupt captain general. He had died of unknown causes on February 14th. As the fleet's alguacil, or master-at-arms, Espinosa had performed as a loyal servant to King Charles. But as a captain, Espinosa was hopelessly out of his element. Espinosa, a soldier, was simply not qualified to command a ship. The challenge of guiding Trinidad halfway around the world, often against the prevailing winds, was beyond him, as it might have been beyond even Magellan had he lived to face it. Espinosa decided to leave behind 4 men to operate a trading post on the island of Tidor. The post would store cloves and serve as a symbol of Spanish rule in the Spice Islands. Setting sail, Espinosa backtracked and followed an easterly course through waters the fleet had already explored, past Gilolo and Morotai, and into the Philippine Sea, all the way to the island of Como, where Trinidad took on more provisions. From this point on, stout easterly headwinds got the better of his navigational skills, and he took a more northerly course. The choice proved disastrous. Although he now understood how large the Pacific Ocean was, his ideas about the location of land masses in the northern hemisphere were deeply flawed. He mistakenly believed that Asia was connected to the American continent, and that misunderstanding led him to assume that if he sailed far enough north, he would catch benign westerly winds. But soon after his departure, the monsoon season started in earnest, bringing with it a seemingly endless succession of storms and drenching rains. A more ill-advised global detour cannot be imagined. One can only wonder what he was thinking as he sailed as far north as Japan, into ever more frigid waters. Even Espinosa admitted that his course placed the ship in peril, first from the weather and then from illness. Finally, Espinosa came to his senses. When I saw the people suffering, he later said, the contrary weather, and that I had been at sea for 5 months, I turned back to the Moluccas. After a brief respite at the Islands of the Thieves to collect water, Espinosa commanded Trinidad to resume her retreat toward Tidore. But as he approached his goal, he received shocking news. On May 13th, 5 weeks after Trinidad's departure from Tidore, a fleet of 7 Portuguese ships, all looking for Magellan and the Armada de Malacca, had arrived at the island. Their leader was Antonio de Brito, bearing a royal appointment as governor of the Spice Islands. Espinosa dispatched a boat bearing a letter for Captain Brito, begging for sympathy. He told a pathetic tale. His ship was in bad condition, down to its last anchor. One storm could send her to the bottom, and he was in desperate need of supplies. Had Magellan been alive, he would never have been so foolish as to write a letter to the Portuguese captain charged with capturing him. And the last thing he would have done was to reveal his whereabouts and weaknesses to the enemy. He would have known there was no chance of mercy from the Portuguese. Rather than the compassion Espinosa expected, the letter only made Brito gloat. After searching the Indies for 3 years, the Portuguese governor now knew exactly where the Armada de Malacca was located, and once he had captured the crew, he would treat them as cruelly as he wished. A few days later, a Portuguese caravel with 20 armed men stormed Bena Canora, the harbor where Espinosa had sought refuge. The soldiers boarded Trinidad, expecting to overwhelm the crew, but they were repelled by the grievous spectacle of men near death, a foul and unhealthy stench that no one dared to brave, and a ship on the verge of sinking. Everything Espinosa had said in his letter to Brito was true. Trinidad and her crew were in desperate condition and offered no threat to the Portuguese. Unmoved, the Portuguese soldiers arrested Espinosa and sailed Magellan's fetid and decrepit flagship to Ternate. There Brito took possession of Trinidad's papers, logbooks, quadrants, and astrolabes. Included in the haul were the diary of Andres de San Martin and, it is said, Magellan's personal logbook. Brito ordered the ship stripped of all her sails and rigging, and in this condition she rode helplessly at anchor until a severe storm hit the island. The wind smashed apart the remains of the once proud ship, her precious cargo of cloves sank, and the splintered remnants of her hull washed ashore. The flagship of the Armada de Malacca ended up as driftwood. Espinosa had squandered his chance for glory. If he had succeeded in guiding Trinidad home, he would have earned a place in history and a fortune for himself. Instead, his indecision claimed the lives of over a score of men, half the remaining assets of the Armada, a valuable cargo of cloves, and the records maintained by Trinidad's officers, including Magellan himself. When Brito perused the logbooks, he became incensed because they contained damning evidence of the Armada's route through Portuguese waters and its attempts to snatch the Spice Islands away from Portugal. His first victim was Pedro Alfonso de la Rosa, the Portuguese renegade who had joined the fleet when it first called at the Spice Islands. He was beheaded. Brito then considered executing several sailors and pilots, but preferred that they die a slow death in the tropical heat. The Portuguese governor did spare the lives of 2 men, a boatswain and carpenter, but he did so only to press them into service for the Portuguese. He sent the rest of the crew to a fortress under construction on the island of Ternate, with orders to help build it, the timber used to construct the Portuguese fort, and the cannon to protect it came from the wreck of Trinidad. Now there was only 1 ship left of the 5 comprising the original Armada de Malacca. This was Victoria, under Elcano's command, and her prospects of returning to Seville appeared even less certain than Trinidad's. Elcano tried repeatedly to set a course around the Cape of Good Hope. The constant pummeling exhausted the crew, and simply finding a quiet moment to consume a few handfuls of barely edible food came to seem a major accomplishment, and getting through the day a miracle of sorts. Of course, the weather continued to batter the boat by night as well, so there was no rest for the crew, nor safe harbor, nor cooking fire, nor soft dry blanket, nor guarantee that their misery would end any time soon. They might double the Cape in a matter of days, but then again they might never be able to accomplish the feat. And if they were forced to turn back, the prospect of starvation in the open stretches of the Indian Ocean, or death at the hands of the Portuguese, awaited them. And so they tried again and again, fleeing for their lives, hoping to cheat death just one more time. Just when it seemed that the Cape was impassable, the wind shifted slightly, and the storms relented briefly. Elcano seized the moment to round Cape Agulhas, the point farthest south on the African continent, with the Cape of Good Hope coming up quickly, almost easy to handle in comparison. Fighting churning waters, sailing as close to the wind as he dared, Elcano finally drove his ship around the Cape of Good Hope. They had survived one more ordeal, and that was enough to give thanks to a merciful Lord.